courting of a young woman. Her suitor was a young man who could read her mind, but did not tell her so. He simply appeared with what she wanted at the moment, beginning with strawberry ice cream for a study break. Step by step, he changed her life, making her dependent upon him by giving her what she thought she wanted at a certain moment, before she herself had a chance to reflect. Her best friend realized that something disconcerting was happening, investigated, and learned the truth. "That is not love," she warned. "That's rape." The internet is a bit like this. It knows much about us, but interacts with us without revealing that this is so. It makes us unfree by arousing our worst tribal impulses and placing them at the service of unseen others. Neither Russia nor the internet is going away. It would help the cause of democracy if citizens knew more about Russian policy and if the concepts of news, journalism, and reporting could be preserved on the internet. In the end, though, freedom depends upon citizens who are able to make a distinction between what is true and what they want to hear. Authoritarianism arrives not because people say that they want it, but because they lose the ability to distinguish between facts and desires. Democracies die when people cease to believe that voting matters. The question is not whether elections are held, but whether they are free and fair. If so, democracy produces a sense of time, an expectation of the future that calms the present. The meaning of each democratic election is the promise of the next one. If we anticipate that another meaningful election will take place, we know that the next time around we can correct our mistakes, which in the meantime we blame upon the people whom we elect. In this way, democracy transforms human fallibility into political predictability and helps us to experience time as movement forward into a future over which we have some influence. If we come to believe that elections are simply a repetitive ritual of support, democracy loses its meaning. The essence of Russia's foreign policy is strategic relativism. Russia cannot become stronger, so it must make others weaker. The simplest way to make others weaker is to make them more like Russia. Rather than addressing its problems, Russia exports them, and one of its basic problems is the absence of a succession principle. Russia opposes European and American democracy to ensure that Russians do not see that democracy might work as a succession principle in their own country. Russians are meant to distrust other systems as much as they distrust their own. If Russia's succession crisis can in fact be exported, if the United States could become authoritarian, then Russia's own problems, although unresolved, would at least seem normal. Pressure on Putin would be relieved. Were America the shining beacon of democracy that its citizens sometimes imagine, its institutions would have been far less vulnerable to Russia's cyber war. From Moscow's perspective, America's constitutional structure created tempting vulnerabilities. Because of the evident flaws in American democracy and the American rule of law, it was all the easier to intervene in an American election. The rule of law requires that the government control violence, and that the population expects that the government can do so. The presence of guns in American society, which can feel like strength to some Americans, appeared in Moscow as a national weakness. In 2016, Russia appealed directly to Americans to buy and use guns, amplifying the rhetoric of the Trump campaign. Trump called for his supporters to exercise their Second Amendment rights against Hillary Clinton were she elected, which was an indirect but transparent suggestion that they should shoot her to death. The Russian cyber campaign was enthusiastic about the right of Americans to bear arms, celebrating the Second Amendment and calling upon Americans to fear terrorism and buy firearms to protect themselves. Meanwhile, Russian authorities were cooperating with the American gun lobby in the real world. A Russian group called Right to Bear Arms cultivated ties with the National Rifle Association, NRA. Its purpose was to influence events within the United States. As its members knew perfectly well, Russians will never have the right to bear arms under the present regime. Two prominent members of Russia's Right to Bear Arms, Maria Butina and Alexander Torshin, were also members of the American NRA, Butina was a student in an American university who co-founded a company with an American working closely with the NRA leadership. Torshin was a Russian central banker wanted in Spain on charges of criminal money laundering. In December 2015, representatives of the NRA visited Moscow, where they met Dmitry Rogozin, a radical nationalist, and a deputy prime minister who was under U.S. sanctions. In February 2016, Butina reported to Torshin from the United States that Trump, NRA member, really is for cooperation with Russia. Torshin met with Donald Trump Jr. in Kentucky that May. That same month, the NRA endorsed Trump and eventually gave some $30 million to his campaign. Its official attitude to Russia, meanwhile, underwent an interesting transformation. Through 2015, the NRA had complained that American policy regarding Russia was too weak. Once the NRA's involvement with Russia began, it said the opposite. Russia's support of the NRA resembled its support of right-wing paramilitaries in Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic. Once Trump was in office, the NRA took a very aggressive tone, proclaiming in a video that "we're coming for" the New York Times. Given that the NRA endorsed and funded Trump, that it was a gun organization, and that Trump called the press an enemy, it was hard to interpret this as anything other than a threat. Democracy depends upon the free exchange of ideas, where free means without the threat of violence. An important sign of the collapse of the rule of law is the rise of a paramilitary and its merger with government power. In 2016, the most obvious weakness in American democracy was the disconnect between voting and results. In most democracies, it would be unthinkable that a candidate who received millions more votes than her rival would lose. This sort of thing happens on a regular basis in American presidential elections, thanks to the indirect and approximate electoral system known as the Electoral College. The American Electoral College accords victory by tallying the electoral votes of states rather than by the number of individual votes. States are allocated electoral votes not by population, but according to the number of federal elected representatives. Since all states have two senators, less populous states have a disproportionate number of electoral votes. Individual votes in small states count for far more than individual votes in large states. Meanwhile, millions of Americans in territories, as opposed to states, have no vote at all. Puerto Rico has more inhabitants than 21 of the 50 American states, but its American citizens have no influence on presidential elections. American states with small populations are also vastly overrepresented in the Senate, the upper house of the American legislature. The population of the largest state is about 80 times the population of the smallest state, but each has two senators. The lower house of the American legislature, the House of Representatives, is elected according to districts that are often drawn to help one party or another. In interwar Yugoslavia, electoral precincts that were drawn to favor the largest ethnicity were known as water districts. In the United States, the process is known as gerrymandering. As a result of gerrymandering, Democratic voters in Ohio or North Carolina in effect have, respectively, about one-half or one-third as much ability to elect a representative in Congress as do Republican voters. Citizens did not have an equal vote. From an American point of view, all of this might appear to be mundane tradition, just the rules of the game. From Moscow's perspective, the system looks like vulnerability to be exploited. When a minority president and a minority party control the executive and legislative branches of government, they can be tempted into a politics where victory depends not upon policy that pleases majorities, but upon further limitation of the franchise. A foreign government that can make the system slightly less representative increases that very temptation, tilting the system towards authoritarianism. Russia's intervention in the 2016 U.S. election was not just an attempt to get a certain person elected. It was also the application of pressure to the structure. The victory of a Russian-backed candidate could be less important in the long run than the evolution of the system as a whole away from democracy. When Russia acted against American democracy, the American system was already becoming less democratic. In the early 2010s, as a new system was consolidated in Russia, the U.S. Supreme Court took two important decisions that shifted the United States towards authoritarianism. In 2010, it ruled that money talked, that corporations were individuals, and their campaign spending was free speech protected by the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. This granted real companies, front companies, and various fake civic entities the right to influence campaigns and, in effect, to try to buy elections. It also prepared the way for Trump to claim, as he did, that in an American oligarchy, Americans could only be safe if they elected their own oligarch, himself. In fact, Trump was a creature of Russian cyber war who never demonstrated that he had any money. But his argument from oligarchy was plausible in a political atmosphere where American voters came to believe that money counted for more than their own preferences. In 2013, the Supreme Court found that racism was no longer a problem in the United States and issued a ruling whose consequences proved the falseness of that premise. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 had required states with a history of suppressing the votes of African Americans to clear changes in their voting laws with the courts. Once the Supreme Court ruled that this was no longer necessary, American states immediately suppressed the vote of African Americans and others. Throughout the American South, polling stations disappeared, often without warning, right before elections. 22 American states passed laws designed to suppress the voting of African Americans and Hispanics, laws that materially affected the 2016 presidential election. In the election of 2016, in the state of Ohio, some 144,000 fewer people voted in counties with large cities than 4 years before. In 2016 in Florida, some 23% of African Americans were denied the vote as convicted felons. Felonies in Florida include releasing a helium balloon and harvesting lobsters with short tails. In 2016 in Wisconsin, some 60,000 fewer people voted than in the previous presidential election. Most of the attrition was in the city of Milwaukee, home to most of the state's African Americans. Barack Obama had won Florida, Ohio, and Wisconsin in 2012. Trump won all three states by narrow margins in 2016, Wisconsin by only 23,000 votes. American race relations presented Russian cyber warriors with an obvious target. Russia ran a site arousing the emotions of friends and families of policemen who were killed in the line of duty, a site exploiting the emotions of friends and families of African Americans killed by police, a site portraying blacks brandishing weapons, a site encouraging blacks to prepare themselves for attacks by whites, a site where fake black activists use a slogan of white supremacists, and a site where fake black rappers refer to the Clintons as serial killers. Russians seized on Native American protests against a pipeline that crossed a burial ground. Although the posts in that campaign were sometimes obviously not Native, the promotion of Russian vodka by Indian activists, for example, was inconceivable, the sites gained followers. Barack Obama's race was important in Russian popular culture. In 2013, a deputy of the Russian parliament shared a doctored photograph on social media that portrayed Barack and Michelle Obama staring longingly at a banana. On Barack Obama's birthday in 2014, Russian students in Moscow projected a laser light show on the U.S. Embassy building, portraying him performing fellatio on a banana. In 2015, a grocery store chain sold a cutting board featuring two parent chimpanzees with Obama's face inserted for the face of a baby chimpanzee. In 2016, a car wash chain promised to wash away all the blackness, making its meaning clear with a picture of a frightened-looking Obama. The year 2016 was, by Chinese reckoning, the year of the monkey. Russians commonly use the term to mean Obama's last year in office. The popular news outlet Life News, for example, titled a feature article, "Slamming the Door on the Year of the Monkey," with a photograph of the American president to remove any doubt as to what was meant. Race was on the Russian mind in 2016. Russian leaders had occasion that year to observe as race opened a tremendous gap between the executive and legislative branches of the American government. In February, one of the 9 Supreme Court justices died. The Republican Majority Leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, made clear that the Senate would not consider any nominee of Barack Obama. This broke one of the most important conventions of the federal government of the United States and was commented upon in Moscow. The Russian press quite rightly noted the paradoxical situation of a president unable to exercise his normal rights. It did not escape the attention of the Kremlin that the Republican leaders of Congress declared, almost a year early, that Barack Obama no longer enjoyed the usual prerogatives of the President of the United States. At that moment, Russia began its email hack of Democratic politicians and activists. In June 2016, Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, was discussing Russia with his fellow Republican congressman. Republican Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy expressed a belief that Donald Trump was paid by Russia. Ryan reacted by asking that such suspicions be kept in the family. An embarrassment within the party was more important than the violation of the sovereignty of the country. The possibility that a Republican candidate for president, who is not yet the party's nominee, was the creation of a foreign power was less worrisome than an awkward press conference at which Republicans would tell citizens what they suspected themselves. This level of partisanship, where the enemy is the opposing party and the outside world is neglected, creates a vulnerability easily exploited by hostile actors in that outside world. The next month, Russia began to release the hacked emails of Democratic politicians and activists. If Moscow's calculation was that Republican leaders would not immediately defend their Democratic colleagues from foreign cyber attack, that was correct. As Republicans realized that Russia was attacking the United States, the fury of partisanship became the desperation of denial, and then the complicity of inaction. That September, McConnell listened to the heads of American intelligence agencies report on the Russian cyber war, but expressed his doubts as to their veracity. It is unknown what the heads of intelligence said, but it is unlikely to be very different from their later public statement. We assess Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an influence campaign aimed at the U.S. presidential election. Russia's goals were to undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. McConnell let it be known that Republicans would treat the defense of the United States from Russian cyber war as an effort to help Hillary Clinton. At that point, Russia had been at work in the United States for more than a year. After McConnell categorized the Russian attack as partisan politics, its scope expanded. A massive Russian bot offensive began right then. At the crucial moment, it was unclear who had more influence over the Republican Party, its human leaders or Russian robots. When indisputable evidence appeared that Trump considered it appropriate to sexually abuse women, McConnell asked him to apologize. But Russian bots and trolls went immediately to work to defend Trump from the charges and to direct Americans to a disclosure of emails engineered to change the subject. Moscow was attacking, and Congress declined to defend the country. The Obama administration might have acted on its own, but was afraid to deepen partisan divisions. "I feel like we sort of choked," as one of its officials put it. Russia won, which is to say that Trump won. Later, Trump named McConnell's wife, Elaine Chao, to his cabinet as Secretary of Transportation. To be sure, a number of Republicans had portrayed Russia as a national security threat to the United States. Back in 2012, the Republican candidate for president, Mitt Romney, had been virtually alone in both parties in portraying Russia as a serious problem. While competing for the 2016 Republican nomination, Ohio Governor John Kasich, who was knowledgeable about East European politics, was quick to associate Trump with Putin. Another Republican rival for the 2016 nomination, the Florida Senator Marco Rubio, claimed that the weakness of Obama's foreign policy encouraged Russian aggression. Senator Rubio's accusation, which was plausible enough, disguised a more profound problem. Though Obama's response to the 2014 Russian invasion of Ukraine was indeed very cautious, in 2016, Obama did at least recognize that Russian intervention in a U.S. election was a problem for the country as a whole. Even as Kasich and Rubio took a stand on Russian foreign policy, the crucial Republican legislators surrendered in advance to Russian cyberattack. It was more important to humiliate a black president than it was to defend the independence of the United States of America. That is how wars are lost. The road to unfreedom is the passage from the politics of inevitability to the politics of eternity. Americans were vulnerable to the politics of eternity because their own experiences had already weakened inevitability. Trump's proposal to make America great again resonated with people who believed, along with him, that the American dream was dead. Russia had reached the politics of eternity first, and so Russians knew the techniques that would push Americans in the same direction. It is easy to see the appeal of eternity to wealthy and corrupt men in control of a lawless state. They cannot offer social advance to their population, and so must find some other form of motion in politics. Rather than discuss reforms, eternity politicians designate threats. Rather than presenting a future with possibilities and hopes, they offer an eternal present with defined enemies and artificial crises. For this to work, citizens have to meet eternity politicians halfway. Demoralized by their inability to change their station in life, they must accept that the meaning of politics lies not in institutional reform, but in daily emotion. They must stop thinking about a better future for themselves, their friends, and their families, and prefer the constant invocation of a proud past. At the top and throughout society, material inequality creates the experiences and the sentiments that can be transformed into a politics of eternity. When Ilin was portrayed as the heroic opponent of the Russian Revolution on Russian television in 2017, it was with the message that the promise of social advancement for the Russian people was a satanic deception. In 2016, Russia was described by Credit Suisse as the most unequal country in the world, as measured by distribution of wealth. Since the end of the Soviet Union, only Russians who have managed to reach the top 10% of annual earners have made any meaningful gains. Russian oligarchy emerged in the 1990s, but was consolidated as the kleptocratic control of the state by a single oligarchical clan under Putin in the 2000s. According to Credit Suisse, in 2016, the top decile of the Russian population owned 89% of the total household wealth. In the report, the United States had a comparable figure, 76% and rising. Typically, billionaires control 1 to 2% of national wealth. In Russia, roughly 100 billionaires owned about a third of the country. At the very top of Russia's grotesque upside-down wealth pyramid were Vladimir Putin and his personal friends. Most often, they gained wealth from Russia's sale of natural gas and oil without any effort on their part. One of Putin's friends, a cellist, became a billionaire for no reason that he could provide. The appeal of the politics of eternity to such men is all too understandable. Far better to shackle a nation and rattle the world than to risk the loss of so much. The case of the billionaire cellist, like so much else about oligarchy, came to light thanks to the work of investigative reporters. In the 2010s, some of the best of them, in revealing projects such as the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers, showed how unregulated international capitalism was creating sinkholes for national wealth. Tyrants first hide and launder their money, then use it to enforce authoritarianism at home, or export it abroad. Money gravitates towards where it cannot be seen, which in the 2010s was in various offshore tax havens. This was a global problem. Estimates of just how much money was parked offshore, beyond the reach of national tax authorities, ranged from $7 trillion to $21 trillion. The United States was an especially permissive environment for Russians who wished to steal and then launder money. Much of the Russian national wealth that was supposed to be building the Russian state in the 2000s and 2010s found its way to shell corporations in offshore havens. Many of these were in America. In June 2016, Jared Kushner, Donald Trump Jr., and Paul Manafort met with Russians in Trump Tower to consider Russian offers to hurt the Clinton campaign. One of the intermediaries was Ike Kavaladze, who worked for Aras Agalarov, the Russian real estate developer who had organized the Miss Universe pageant for Trump in 2013. Kavaladze set up anonymous companies in Delaware, at least 2,000. This was legal, since the state of Delaware, like the states of Nevada and Wyoming, permitted the foundation of companies by ghosts. In Delaware, 285,000 distinct entities were registered at a single physical address. Russians used shell companies to purchase American real estate, often anonymously. In the 1990s, Trump Tower was one of only two buildings in New York City to allow anonymous purchases of apartment units, an opportunity that the Russian mob quickly exploited. Wherever anonymous real estate purchases were allowed, Russians bought and sold apartments, often hiding behind shell companies, as a way to transform dirty rubles into clean dollars. These practices impoverished Russian society and consolidated the Russian oligarchy during the Putin years, and allowed Donald Trump to claim to be a very successful businessman. In this particular way, the American politics of inevitability, the idea that unregulated capitalism could only bring democracy, supported the Russian politics of eternity, the certainty that democracy was a sham. The American politics of inevitability also prepared the way for the American politics of eternity more directly, by generating and legitimizing vast economic inequality at home. If there was no alternative to capitalism, then perhaps yawning gaps in wealth and income should be ignored, explained away, or even welcomed. If more capitalism meant more democracy, why worry? These mantras of inevitability provided the cover for the policies that made America more unequal and inequality more painful. In the 1980s, the federal government weakened the position of trade unions. The percentage of Americans in unionized jobs fell from about a quarter to under 10%. Private sector union membership fell still more sharply, from about 34% to 8% for men, and from about 16% to 6% for women. The productivity of the American workforce grew throughout the period at about 2% a year, but the wages of traditional workers increased more slowly, if at all. Over the same period, the pay of executives increased, sometimes drastically. At the same time, the United States was very weak on the basic policies that stabilized middle classes elsewhere: retirement pensions, public education, public transport, health care, paid vacation, and parental leave. The United States had the resources to give its workers and its citizens these basics. Yet a regressive trend in taxation policy made this more difficult. Whereas workers paid an increasing tax burden through payroll taxes, corporations and wealthy families saw theirs drop by half or more. Even as the percentage of income and wealth at the top of the American distribution increased, the percentage of tax expected from the most fortunate decreased. Since the 1980s, the tax rates paid by the top 0.1% of American earners fell from about 65% to about 35%, and for the top 0.01%, from about 75% to below 25%. During the presidential campaign, Trump asked Americans to remember when America was great. What his supporters had in mind were the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, decades when the gap between the wealthiest and the rest was shrinking. Between 1940 and 1980, the bottom 90% of American earners gained more wealth than the top 1% did. This condition of growing equality was what Americans remember with warmth as the time of American greatness. Unions were strong until the 1980s. The welfare state was expanding in the 1950s and the 1960s. Wealth was more evenly distributed, thanks in large part to government policy. In the era of inevitability, all of this changed. Inequality of income and wealth grew drastically from the 1980s through the 2010s. In 1978, the top 0.1% of the population, about 160,000 families, controlled 7% of American wealth. By 2012, the position of this tiny elite was even stronger. It controlled about 22% of American wealth. At the very top, the total wealth of the top 0.01%, about 16,000 families, increased by a factor of more than 6 over the same period. In 1978, a family in the top 0.01% was about 222 times as rich as the average American family. By 2012, such a family was about 1,120 times richer. Since 1980, 90% of the American population has gained essentially nothing, either in wealth or income. All gains have gone to the top 10%, and within the top 10%, most of the top 1%, and within the top 1%, most of the top 0.1%, and within the top 0.1%, most of the top 0.01%. In the 2010s, the United States approached the Russian standard of inequality. Although no American oligarchical clan has as yet captured the state, the emergence of such groups in the 2010s, Kochs, Mercers, Trumps, Murdochs, was hard to miss. Just as Russians used American capitalism to consolidate their own power, Americans cooperated with the Russian oligarchy with the same purpose, in the 2016 Trump presidential campaign, for example. Most likely, Trump's preference for Putin over Obama was not just a matter of racism or rivalry. It was also an aspiration to be more like Putin, to be in his good graces, or to have access to greater wealth. Oligarchy works as a patronage system that dissolves democracy, law, and patriotism. American and Russian oligarchs have far more in common with one another than they do with their own populations. At the top of the wealth ladder, the temptations of the politics of eternity will be much the same in America as in Russia. There is little reason to expect that Americans would behave better than Russians when placed in similar situations. For many Americans, oligarchy meant the warping of time, the loss of a sense of the future, the experience of every day as repetitive stress. When economic inequality suppresses social advance, it is hard to imagine a better future, or indeed any future. As an American worker put it during the Great Depression of the 1930s, fear does distort your outlook and your feeling. Lost time and lost faith. An American born in 1940 was almost certain to make more money than his parents. An American born in 1984 had about a 50-50 chance of doing the same. Billy Joel's 1982 song Allentown, which was really about the neighboring steel town of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, caught the moment. It spoke of men of a second post-war generation without the social advancement attained by their fathers, of workers betrayed by narrow nationalism. The fate of the steel industry, like that of the American labor market generally, had much to do with changes in the world economy. The number of manufacturing jobs decreased by about one-third between 1980 and 2016. The problem was that American leaders took globalization as the solution to its own problems, rather than as an invitation to reform the American state. The globalization of the 1990s, 2000s, and 2010s coincided instead with the politics of inevitability and the generation of economic inequality. Inequality means not only poverty, but the experience of difference. Visible inequality leads Americans to reject the American dream as unlikely or impossible. Meanwhile, more and more Americans are unable to change residences, which also makes better futures hard to imagine. In the 2010s, more Americans between the ages of 18 and 34 lived with their parents than in any other configuration. A young person who became a teacher and took a job in a public school in San Francisco could not afford to buy a home anywhere in the city. In other words, an American who completes an education and takes a job of the highest public value is not sufficiently rewarded to start what was once considered a normal life. A sense of doom pressed down especially on youth. More than a fifth of American families reported owing debt for college in the 2010s. Exposure to inequality persuaded American teens to drop out of high school, which then in turn made it very hard for them to earn. Children down to the age of 4 suffered in testing if they were raised in poorer families. As Warren Buffett put it, "There's class warfare, all right, but it's my class, the rich class, that's making war, and we're winning." Americans die in this war every day, in large numbers, in incomparably greater numbers than in wars abroad or as a result of terrorism at home. Because the United States lacks a functional public health system, inequality has brought a health crisis, which in turn has accelerated and reinforced inequality. It was in counties where public health collapsed in the 2010s that Trump gained the votes that won him the election. The factor that most strongly correlated with a Trump vote was a local public health crisis, especially where that crisis included high rates of suicide. About 20 American military veterans killed themselves every day in the 2010s. Among farmers, the rate was still higher. Believing that tomorrow will be worse than today, Americans, especially white Americans, engaged in behaviors that were likely to reduce their lifespan. The association between declining health and Trump voting was strong in important states that Obama had won in 2012, but which Trump took in 2016, such as Ohio, Florida, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. When life is short, and the future is troubled, the politics of eternity beckons. A spectacular consequence of the American politics of inevitability in the 2010s was the legalization and popularization of opioids. For hundreds of years, it has been known that such chemicals are addictive. Yet in the absence of normal institutions of public health, and in an atmosphere of unregulated capitalism, such basic wisdom could be overwhelmed by marketing. In effect, the United States declared an opium war against itself, making normal life impossible for millions of people, and normal politics much more difficult for everyone. American citizens in the 1990s, already the test subjects in a grand experiment in inequality, were simultaneously exposed to the uncontrolled release of manufactured opioids. OxyContin, which works like heroin in pill form, was approved for prescription in 1995. Marketing representatives for the company that produced it, Purdue Pharma, told doctors that a miracle had occurred, the pain-killing benefits of heroin without the addictiveness. In the late 1990s, in southern Ohio and eastern Kentucky, Purdue Pharma marketing representatives earned bonuses of more than $100,000 a quarter. In 1998, the first pill mills began to emerge in Portsmouth, Ohio. These were purported medical facilities where physicians were paid to prescribe OxyContin or other opioids. Residents of Portsmouth and then other towns soon became addicts and began to die of overdoses. Some switched to heroin. Scioto County, Ohio, of which Portsmouth is the county seat, has a population of about 80,000 people. In a single year, its residents were prescribed 9.7 million pills, which comes to 120 pills for every man, woman, and child. Extreme though this might seem, such numbers became typical in much of the United States. In the state of Tennessee, for example, about 400 million pills were prescribed 1 year to a population of about 6 million, so about 70 pills per person. In Russia and in Ukraine, in 2014, 2015, and 2016, people often talked about zombies and zombification. During the Russian occupation of southern and southeastern Ukraine, each side claimed that the other had been zombified, drawn into a trance by the hypnotic power of its own propaganda. The Donbas was not so very different from Appalachia. Indeed, in the 2010s, America had multiple Donbasses, places of confusion and hopelessness where deep declines in expectations gave rise to faith and easy solutions. Zombification was as pronounced in America as it was in eastern Ukraine. People in Portsmouth with unwashed hair and gray faces could be seen tearing the metal objects from one another's houses, carrying them through town, and selling them for pills. For about a decade, opioids served as currency in that city, as they did among soldiers or mercenaries on both sides of the war in Ukraine. The opioid plague was not widely discussed during its first 2 decades, and so grew national. About half of the unemployed men in the United States have been prescribed pain medication. In the year 2015, some 95 million Americans took prescription painkillers. For middle-aged white men, deaths from opioid abuse, along with other deaths of despair, canceled out gains in treatment of cancer and heart disease. Beginning in 1999, mortality among middle-aged white males in the United States began to increase. The death rate from drug overdose tripled between 1999 and 2016, when overdoses killed 63,600 Americans. While life expectancy in developed nations increased around the world, it fell in the United States in 2015 and then again in 2016. When Trump was campaigning for the Republican nomination, he did best in the primary elections in places where middle-aged white males were at greatest risk of death. Anyone who suffers from pain knows that a pill can mean getting through a day or even getting out of bed. But OxyContin and heroin create their own special sort of pain through pleasure, overwhelming the mu receptors in our spines and brains, creating in us a craving for evermore. Opioids hinder the development of the frontal cortex of the brain, which is where the capacity to make choices forms in adolescence. Persistent opioid use makes it harder for people to learn from experience or to take responsibility for their actions. The drug colonizes the mental and social space needed for children, spouses, friends, jobs, the world. At the extreme of addiction, the world becomes a mute and isolated experience of pleasure and need. Time collapses into a cycle from this hit to the next one. The shift from the sense that everything is wonderful to the sense that everything is dark and foreboding becomes normal. Life itself becomes a manufactured crisis, one which seems to have no end except life's end. Americans were prepared by drugs for the politics of eternity, for the sense of doom interrupted only by the quick hit. At least 2 million Americans were addicted to opioids at the time of the 2016 presidential election, and tens of millions more were taking pills. The correlation between opioid use and Trump voting was spectacular and obvious, notably in the states that Trump had to win. In New Hampshire, traumatized counties such as Coos swung from Obama in 2012 to Trump in 2016. Every Pennsylvania county that Obama won in 2012 but Trump won in 2016 was an opioid crisis. Mingo County, West Virginia, was one of the places in America most touched by opioids. A town in Mingo County with a population of 3,200 was shipped about 2 million opioid pills per year. Mingo County went Republican in 2012, but in 2016, Trump took 19% more votes than did Mitt Romney 4 years earlier. With one exception, every Ohio county in opioid crisis posted significant gains for Trump in 2016 over Romney in 2012, which helped him to win a state that he had to take to win the election. In Scioto County, Ohio, ground zero of the American opioid epidemic, Trump took a spectacular 33% more votes than Romney had. It was in the localities where the American dream had died that Trump's politics of eternity worked. He called for a return to the past, to a time when America was great. Without inequality, without a sense that the future was closed, he could not have found the supporters he needed. The tragedy was that his idea of governance was to transform a dead dream into a zombie nightmare. The politics of eternity triumphs when fiction comes to life. A leader from the realm of fiction tells lies without remorse or apology, because for him, untruth is existence. The fictional creation, Donald Trump, successful businessman, filled the public space with untruth and never apologized for lies, since doing so would be to recognize that such a thing as truth existed. On 91 of his first 99 days in office, Trump made at least one claim that was blatantly wrong. In the course of his first 298 days, he made 1,628 false or misleading claims. In a half-hour interview, he made 24 false or misleading claims, which, allowing for the time the interviewer was speaking, is about one per minute. It is true that all presidents lie. The difference is that for Trump, telling the truth was the exception. Many Americans did not see the difference between someone who constantly lied and never apologized and someone who almost never did and corrected his or her mistakes. They were accepting the description of the world offered by Surkov and RT. No one really ever tells the truth, perhaps there is no truth, so let us simply repeat the things we like to hear and obey those who say them. That way lies authoritarianism. Trump adopted the Russian double standard. He was permitted to lie all the time, but any minor error by a journalist discredited the entire profession of journalism. Trump made the move, copied from Putin, of claiming that it was not he, but the reporters who lied. He referred to them as an enemy of the American people and claimed that what they produced was fake news. Trump was proud of both of these formulations, although both were Russian. In the Russian model, investigative reporting must be marginalized so that news can become a daily spectacle. The point of spectacle is to summon the emotions of both supporters and detractors and to confirm and strengthen polarization. Every news cycle creates euphoria or depression and reinforces a conviction that politics is about friends and enemies at home, rather than about policy that might improve the lives of citizens. Trump governed just as he had run for office, as a producer of outrage rather than as a formulator of policy. The politics of eternity tempts with a cycle of nostalgia and delivers a cycle of conflict. Trump arrived in the Oval Office at a moment when levels of inequality in the United States approached those of Russia. Wealth and income in the United States had not been so unevenly distributed between the top 0.1% and the rest of the population since 1929, the year before the Great Depression. When Trump spoke of making America great again, his followers thought of the decades after the Second World War, a time when inequality was shrinking. Trump himself meant the disastrous 1930s. And not just the Great Depression as it had actually happened, but something even more extreme and frightful. An alternative world where nothing was done, at home or abroad, to address its consequences. The slogan of Trump's campaign and his presidency was America First. This was a reference to the 1930s, or rather to an alternative America of increasing racial and social inequality that was not met with public policy. In the 1930s, the phrase America First was used to oppose both the welfare state proposed by Franklin D. Roosevelt and the entrance of the United States into the Second World War. The public face of the America First movement, the pilot Charles Lindbergh, argued that the United States ought to make common cause with Nazis as fellow white Europeans. To say America First in the 2010s was to establish a point of mythical innocence in an American politics of eternity, to embrace inequality as natural, to deny that anything should have been done back then or could be done now. In Trump's politics of eternity, the Second World War lost its meaning. In previous decades, Americans had come to think that a virtue of the war was the fight against Nazi racism, which, in its turn, offered lessons for improving the United States. The Trump administration undermined this American memory of the good war. In a speech to Navajo veterans, Trump permitted himself a racist reference to a political rival. He managed to mark Holocaust Remembrance Day without mentioning Jews. His spokesman Sean Spicer claimed that Hitler did not kill his own people. The idea that German Jews were not part of the German people is how the Holocaust began. The politics of eternity demands that effort be directed against the enemy, which can be the enemy within. The people always means, as Trump himself put it, the real people, not the entire citizenry, but some chosen group. Like his Russian patrons, Trump portrayed the presidency of Barack Obama as an aberration. Along with RT, Trump promoted the fiction that Obama was not an American, an idea meant to strengthen the notion that the people are whites. Like Putin with his monkey imitation, like Ilin and his obsession with jazz as white emasculation, like Prokhanov with his nightmares of black milk and black sperm, Trump dwelled in fantasies of black power. When Trump won the presidency, Kisilov exulted that Obama was now like a eunuch who could not do anything. Trump was the only presidential candidate in American history to brag publicly about his penis. His white supremacist supporters called Republicans who would not support Trump's racism cuckservatives. The reference was to the pornographic meme of a white husband cuckold to a white wife who watches her perform fellatio on a black man. To sexualize the enemy was to make politics into biological conflict and to trade the hard work of reform and freedom for endless, anxious preening. In an American eternity, the enemy is black, and politics begins by saying so. Thus, the next point of innocence in Trump's politics of eternity, after the 1930s-era racist isolationism of America First, was an alternative 1860s, in which the Civil War was never fought. In actual American history, African Americans were enfranchised a few years after the American Civil War of 1861 to 1865. If blacks are to be excluded from the people, an American politics of eternity has to keep them in bondage. And thus, just as the Trump administration questioned the wisdom of fighting Hitler, it also questioned the wisdom of fighting slavery. Speaking of the Civil War, Trump asked, "Why could that one not have been worked out?" His chief of staff, John Kelly, claimed that the cause of the Civil War was the absence of compromise, suggesting that if people had been more reasonable, the United States might have reasonably remained a country where black people were reasonably enslaved. In the minds of some of Trump's supporters, the approval of the Holocaust and the endorsement of slavery were intertwined. In a major extreme right demonstration in Charlottesville, Virginia, Nazi and Confederate symbols appeared together. To proclaim America First was to deny any need to fight fascism either at home or abroad. When American Nazis and white supremacists marched in Charlottesville in August 2017, Trump said that some of them were very fine people. He defended the Confederate and Nazi cause of preserving monuments to the Confederacy. Such monuments in the American South were raised in the 1920s and 1930s, at a time when fascism in the United States was a real possibility. They memorialized the racial purification of Southern cities that was contemporary with the rise of fascism in Europe. Contemporary observers had no difficulty seeing the connection. Will Rogers, the great American entertainer and social commentator of his time, saw Adolf Hitler in 1933 as a familiar figure. Papers all state that Hitler is trying to copy Mussolini. Looks to me it's the KKK he's copying. The great American social thinker and historian, W.E.B. Du Bois, could see how the temptations of fascism worked together with American myths of the past. He rightly feared that American whites would prefer a story about enmity with blacks to a reforming state that would improve prospects for all Americans. Whites distracted by racism could become, as he wrote in 1935, the instrument by which democracy in the nation was done to death, race provincialism deified, and the world delivered to plutocracy, what we call oligarchy. An American politics of eternity takes racial inequality and makes it a source of economic inequality, turning whites against blacks, declaring hatred normal and change impossible. It begins from fictional premises and makes fictional policy. Americans living in the countryside tend to believe that their taxes are distributed to people in the cities, although the opposite is the case. Many white Americans, especially whites who voted for Trump, believe that whites suffer more from discrimination than do blacks. This is a legacy of American history that reaches back to the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, when President Andrew Johnson defined political equality for African Americans as discrimination against whites. Believers in the politics of inevitability might imagine that, in the course of time, people will become more educated and commit fewer errors. Believers in public policy might try to design reforms that would help people to overcome inequalities regardless of their beliefs. A politician of eternity such as Trump uses false beliefs about past and present to justify fictional policies that reaffirm those false beliefs, making of politics an eternal struggle against enemies. An eternity politician defines foes rather than formulating policies. Trump did so by denying that the Holocaust concerned Jews, by using the expression son of a bitch in reference to black athletes, by calling a political opponent Pocahontas, by overseeing a denunciation program that targeted Mexicans, by publishing a list of crimes committed by immigrants, by transforming an office on terrorism into an office on Islamic terrorism, by helping hurricane victims in Texas and Florida, but not in Puerto Rico, by speaking of shithole countries, by referring to reporters as enemies of the American people, by claiming that protesters were paid, and so on. American citizens could read these signs. A Republican congressional candidate physically attacked a reporter who was asking him a question about health care. An American Nazi attacked two women on a train in Portland and stabbed two men to death when they tried to protect them. In Washington state, a white man ran over two Native Americans in his car while shouting racial slurs. Teachers reported in multiple surveys that the Trump presidency was increasing racial tension in their classrooms. The word Trump became a racial taunt at school sporting events. Insofar as the American politics of eternity generates policy, its purpose is to inflict pain. Regressive taxes that transfer wealth from the majority of the country to the very rich, and the reduction or elimination of health care. The politics of eternity works as a negative-sum game, where everyone but the top 1% or so of the population does worse, and the resulting suffering is used to keep the game going. People get the feeling of winning because they believe that others are losing. Trump was a loser since he could only win thanks to Russia. Republicans were greater losers since he had trapped their party. Democrats were still greater losers since they were excluded from power. And the Americans who suffer from deliberately engineered inequality and health crisis were the greatest losers of all. So long as enough Americans understood losing as a sign that others must be losing still more, the logic could continue. If Americans could be induced to see politics as racial conflict rather than as work for a better common future, they would expect nothing better. Trump was called a populist. A populist, however, is someone who proposes policies to increase opportunities for the masses, as opposed to the financial elites. Trump was something else, a sadopopulist, whose policies were designed to hurt the most vulnerable part of his own electorate. Encouraged by presidential racism, such people could understand their own pain as a sign of still greater pain inflicted upon others. The only major policy of 2017 was to increase pain, a tax regression law that created a budgetary argument against funding domestic programs, and which included among its provisions the deprivation of health care for many of those who needed it most. In Trump's words, "I've ended the individual mandate for health insurance." This means that the Affordable Care Act, which had extended health insurance among uninsured Americans, was, in his words, basically dead over time. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the health care provisions of the 2017 tax bill will result in the loss of health insurance for 13 million Americans. As an envoy from the United Nations warned, these policies could make the United States the most unequal country in the world. From an outside perspective, it was easy to conclude that pain was the purpose of such policies. On one level, a poor person, unemployed worker, or opioid addict who votes away health care is just giving money to the rich that they do not need and perhaps will not even notice. On another level, such a voter is changing the currency of politics from achievement to suffering, from gain to pain, helping a leader of choice establish a regime of sadopopulism. Such a voter can believe that he or she has chosen who administers their pain, and can fantasize that this leader will hurt enemies still more. The politics of eternity converts pain to meaning, and then meaning back into more pain. In this respect, America under President Trump was becoming like Russia. In strategic relativism, Russia hurt, but aimed to make others hurt more, or at least to convince the Russian population that others were hurting more. Russian citizens took the pain of European and American sanctions after the Russian invasion of Ukraine because they believed that Russia was in a glorious campaign against Europe and America, and that Europeans and Americans were getting their just desserts for their decadence and aggression. A fictional justification for war creates real pain that then justifies the continuation of a real war. In winning a battle of that war, in helping Trump to become president, Moscow was spreading this very logic inside the United States. Moscow won a negative-sum game in international politics by helping to turn American domestic politics into a negative-sum game. In the Russian politics of eternity, Russian citizens trade the prospect of a better future for the vision of a valiant defense of Russian innocence. In an American politics of eternity, white Americans trade the prospect of a better future for the vision of a valiant defense of American innocence. Some Americans can be persuaded to live shorter and worse lives, provided that they are under the impression, rightly or wrongly, that blacks, or perhaps immigrants or Muslims, suffer still more. If people who support the government expect their reward to be pain, then a democracy based upon policy competition between parties is endangered. Under Trump, Americans came to expect the administration of pain and pleasure, the daily outrage or triumph. For supporters and opponents alike, experience of politics became an addictive behavior, like time spent online or on heroin, a cycle of good and bad moments spent all alone. Few expected that the federal government could generate new and constructive policies. In the short term, a government that does not seek to legitimate itself with policy will be tempted to do so with terror, as in Russia. In the long term, a government that cannot assemble a majority through reforms will destroy the principle of rule by majority. Such a turn away from democracy and the rule of law seemed to be Trump's preferred course. Trump was the first presidential candidate to say that he would reject the vote tally if he did not win the election, the first in more than 100 years to urge his followers to physically beat his opponent, the first to suggest, twice, that his opponent should be murdered, the first to suggest as a major campaign theme that his opponent should be imprisoned, and the first to communicate internet memes from fascists. As president, he expressed his admiration for dictators around the world. He won the presidency and his party's majority in both chambers of the American legislature, thanks to the undemocratic elements of the American system. Trump was keenly aware of the fact, tediously repeating that he did not really lose the popular vote, even though he had done so by a wide margin. His Russian supporters tried to make him feel better. Первый канал falsely reported, for example, that Clinton had only won the popular election because millions of dead souls had cast their ballots for her. The electoral logic of sadopopulism is to limit the vote to those who benefit from inequality and to those who like pain, and take the vote away from those who expect government to endorse equality and reform. Trump began his administration by naming a